Welcome to the Real Estate Espresso Podcast, your morning shot of what's new in the world of real estate investing. I'm your host, Victor Menashe, and this is the weekend edition where we interview notable people from the world of real estate investing. Today's no exception. We have a great guest, but first, let's say a quick thank you to our sponsor. The Future of Money and Wealth was the premier conference of its type of 2018. It focused on how to position yourself for what we all know is coming, but just can't quite predict when. It's not about how much money you make, it's about how much wealth you keep. If you missed the Future of Money and Wealth, we have an amazing offer for you. The entire conference was video recorded, and you can get access to all 14 hours of the insights from some of the brightest minds on the planet. I'm talking about Robert Kiyosaki, Simon Black, Chris Martinson, Adam Taggart, Ed Griffin, Dr. Doug Duncan, Brian London, and so many more. If you'd like to learn more about how you can get access to this amazing video series, send me an email to fmw@victorjm.com. That's fmw@victorjm.com. We are back. Here on the Weekend Edition, we interview notable people from the world of real estate investing. We've got a great guest today. We have Ryan Wright from DoHardMoney.com. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So Ryan, how did you get into the hard money lending business? That's not necessarily what people tell their elementary school teacher they're going to be when they grow up.
Yeah, definitely. I didn't know that was the direction. You know, it's kind of one of those situations where when opportunities and doors open, I took them and it led me to where I'm at here. I didn't come from the banking side, which a lot of people do. They come from the, you know, lending and banking and those things. I actually came as being an agent. After being an agent, I started investing in rental properties, duplexes, fourplexes, that type of stuff. From there, I got into flipping properties myself. First, I helped other people flip properties as an agent because I was too scared to do it myself. I started flipping myself as well, flipping, wholesaling. And then from there, in being a real estate flipper, I saw the need for reliable capital that understood those needs as a real estate investor. And so we started lending money at that point in time. And the rest is history, so they say.
When you go into the lending business, you have a couple of choices. You can either use your own capital until you run out, or you can raise capital. How did you decide to capitalize the lending business?
Well, it's actually an interesting story. I had a customer of mine as a real estate agent that I actually prospected to. I found him, going after for rent by owner, and he lived out of the country. He was originally from my area, and I got in touch with him, and I started liquidating some of his properties. Over the years, he had acquired quite a few properties, and he was tired of being a landlord. And then one day, he came into town about once a year, and one day he came into town, and we'd liquidated probably $5 million worth of real estate and over the course of many years. And he just said, "Hey, I've been testing you over the years. I like you. I trust you. You know, you've done what you've said, and I've got a bunch of money. I don't want to be a landlord. I keep the properties I like. Everything else I got rid of. What do you think we should do with this money?" And like a lightning bolt, I'm like, "Hey, hard money is the space. It's such a problem. It's an underserved market. You never know if the guy's going to give you the money or not. You never know what they'll lend on and what they won't. So let's just establish some solid guidelines and say this is what we'll do and this is what we won't do." And it took off like wildfire. Some of it was my capital. Most of it was this financial investor of ours that we'd had a relationship for years. And then it just grew from there.
Fascinating. I guess the obvious question is, what is your sweet spot? What is the ideal project for you that you look to lend on?
Well, I'm a common sense guy. So most of the projects that we do is sub FHA, meaning if you know the FHA, you know, limit that they'll lend, we like to be in properties where 80% or 90% of the buyers can actually afford to buy those properties. Having gone through the 2008, you know, financial crisis, real estate crisis, whatever crisis you want to call it, we've learned that being in those FHA in properties is probably the best. So in most of our areas, we're around 200,000, 250,000. A lot of our deals are $150,000. We're not the guys trying to make a home run going for a multi-million dollar property. personally, I feel like those are the most volatile. They're the quickest to go down. They're the in value. They're the slowest to come up in value. And so I really like the median price range below the median, actually, that FHA price range is the blue collar homes, the, you know, 4-bedroom, 2-bathroom, 2-car garage with a white picket fence is kind of the, in my areas, in a lot of my areas, that's kind of the ideal situation for the majority of buyers. 80% of the buyers can buy that house.
So make sure no listeners are left behind when you're talking FHA. I'm assuming you're talking about an FHA 203B lending criteria?
It's a traditional FHA loan. So the end buyer can just go and get an FHA loan, meaning in the United States, you know, the federal government is going to help insure or reinsure that loan for the lending institution. The end buyer only has to come up with 3.5% down or 3% down, and you can get this seller can actually pay the closing costs for the buyer other than that 3% or 3.5%. So it's the majority of that mid-market or lower-end market is getting those types of loans. They don't have to come up with 20%. So it's a very resellable house. If this house can be sold FHA, Federal Housing Authority, it just means that there's a lot of buyer pool out there and somebody isn't going to have to put a huge down payment. So those are the properties I think are the best to be targeting because they're the easiest to liquidate and it has the biggest buyers pool.
That makes a lot of sense. Now, does that mean because you're capped in terms of the value that you're looking to lend on, that excludes you from certain geographic markets?
It does in some ways. I mean, we have the ability to go higher prices, so we can do above that. So my sweet spot is doing those areas that are those sub FHAs, that $150,000 to $250,000. We have the ability to do bigger deals. They have some different criteria than some of the smaller deals may have. So yes, there are some areas that we just simply aren't in because of several reasons, either foreclosure laws or usury laws or eviction timeframes. Those types of things could prohibit us from being there. There's other areas where we're there, but we don't do a ton of business just because of the higher price ranges. But we do have options in the higher price ranges that we can offer. So it's not a one size fits all. We've got several different programs and things that we can do and lending options. But that sweet spot and the place I like to play is that sub FHA price range.
One of the traditional views of hard money is that it's a very local type of business. Many hard money lenders like to lend within a geographic radius of where they reside, simply because it makes doing the due diligence simpler. Obviously, you know, due diligence falls into three categories. There's the mechanics of the specific deal, there's the people, and of course, the market. And it's hard to have that level of depth and expertise nationwide. You just can't get that much, you know, that many boots on the ground in order to do a thorough job against all three of those. How do you handle that?
Yeah, great question. I mean, for us, we started in the business here in my local area, and there were some changes in local laws and a few things where we started moving out to other areas, and so we actually don't even lend in my local marketplaces, kind of where I grew up and know the area. So for us to be able to do that appropriately, there was a couple things that we needed to do. One, we needed to make relationships with our people on the ground in the area. So every house that we go take a look at, we have somebody that lives within 10 miles of the property that we have a relationship with that goes and looks at the property. We actually send two. They're typically licensed agents or licensed appraisals. They do a what we call an evaluation for us. So they take a look at the property. And we want the two independent values to be within 10% of each other. If we have a huge variance in values, if I send two guys that know the area and their values are not within 10% of each other, it tells me either one of two things. It tells me the guy that went out there, one of them didn't know what they were doing, or it tells me that the area is so volatile that values are all over the board. And so then in that case, we send a third person and then we make a determination from there. We typically take the lowest out of our three, you know, people we know, like, and trust are in the area. The second aspect of your question is really knowing the mechanical systems. And, you know, with that, we have project managers and we rely heavily on them to know the scope of work that needs to be done, as well as looking over that to make sure that we're industry pricing in the area.
Fascinating. Now, when you conduct an appraisal, I mean, you're assuming, I guess, that the end buyer here is going to be an owner-occupant. Are you also investing in investment properties?
It's got to be an investment for the person we're giving the loan. It has to be an investment. So they're buying it to flip it or wholesale it or turn it into a rental property type thing. Ours is typically short-term money. We can go into a longer term, but typically to get the rehab done or just take it down and get rid of it quickly is typically the loans that we're doing. And so if somebody wants to, you know, turn it into a duplex or you know, have it rent the property, I should say, then we can talk about some takeout financing, or in some cases, they just want to go down to their bank once the rehab's done and get a loan that way, which is more than fine with us.
Of course. Of course. Yeah. I mean, when I think about appraised values, I think about the three different methods that are usually used for appraisal. You know, you've typically got comparable sales as number one, replacement cost, number two, and then multiples of net income if it's an income property as number three. Sounds like you're relying primarily on comparable sales.
Correct.
You've done an awesome job of gaining some national attention. You've got appearances in USA Today. You're prominent on Realtor.com. Tell us a little bit about how you've managed to promote the business and gain some of this national visibility.
You know, we just try and do good business. You know, in this marketplace, there's ups and downs. There's frustrations. I consider good real estate investors are really people that know how to solve problems. And so we just try and always do the right thing. And then the notoriety has came. I mean, just recently we won Inc. 5000s. We were on the Inc. 5000 fastest growing companies in North America list. And we actually made an 1852, I think was our ranking on that. So super high on that list. We've been fortunate with a lot of things. And so I think it really comes down to doing good business and treating people fairly. And from there, I think the notoriety just happens. So we're honored and humbled by it, frankly. I'm just a small kid that grew up on the west side of the tracks and has just worked hard and we're humbled by it.
I love that. When a lender lends money, they're really only asking one question. They ask it 50 different ways, but the question is, if I lend you money, how am I getting it back?
Yeah, right? I like that.
So it's, you know, how am I getting it back if things go well? How am I getting it back if things don't go well? Talk a little bit about those exception cases when it doesn't go well. What's been your experience?
Yeah, great question. It happens more than I'd like to admit, to be honest. Usually it comes down to an individual trying to push the values to think the property's worth more than what it really is. And I think people just get too optimistic instead of being too not realistic enough. And that's a big concern of ours, is that we're using realistic values, and maybe you can get $300,000 on that house, but let's just say $250,000, you know, because there's a lot of comps to support that. I find a lot of people fall in love with comps. They fall in love with the one property and say, my house is going to sell for that. When the reality is there needs to be multiple. So we look at actives and solds. We want to see three or four actives and three or four solds. The second thing is they just underestimate the amount of repairs, and they never look at a worst case scenario. So do I have some extra money? Do I have something set aside for one of those problems? And so it's usually the perfect storm of them thinking they'll get a little bit more and then trying to work out a deal where they find the cheapest contractor, and that cheapest contractor falls out when they start the project and runs away with a draw, and then they find themselves in a problem. And in that circumstance, we've got to step in and take that project over to protect our financial investors and the capital that we've outlined there. The biggest thing we try and do is we'll work with a borrower we'll give them help. We'll give them support. We have a project manager that talks to them and their contractor every single week. We have a servicing team that's going to talk to them every single week. Like, we're going to do everything we can to help them to make that successful. And if not, when we get to a certain point, if there's movement, we're happy. So we're just saying, okay, I want to see activity. What have we gotten done this week? And if there's a justifiable reason why it didn't get done, that they can show us, not just, you know, their word for it, but they can show us that something legitimately happened, we're happy to look at that. But when we get to a point where there's no movement and nothing's happening, then we have to step in at that point in time. And we hate to see that. I mean, our dream is to watch people thrive in flipping their first property. But if you overestimate the value and underestimate the repairs and hire, you know, the wrong guy, it can turn into a bad situation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, it's like you said, your focus is on just doing good business.
Absolutely.
How do you vet the people that you're going to lend to? Because it sounds like you're doing primarily asset-based lending. How do you vet the people to make sure that they're setting things up for success? I mean, apart from reviewing their pro forma, and maybe giving it a bit of a haircut. How do you know that they're getting it right?
Well, we really don't know if the person we do a lot of new investors. And so that's exciting, but it's also challenging. The exciting part is to see somebody do their first deal and make some money. The challenging part is the lack of education that individual may have, or the lack of real life experience to know that there's going to be bumps in the road, because it never goes the way you think it's going to go. And I think that's challenging for a lot of investors, thinking, oh, everything's going to work out perfect. I've never seen a deal work out perfect. There's always going to be a challenge. So as far as vetting the individual, we're really just making sure we're working with somebody that doesn't have judgments, doesn't have collections, those types of things. They're not in the middle of a foreclosure or in the middle of a bankruptcy. But we'll work with people that don't have the best credit scores or anything else, because we really are lending based upon the asset. And so if we underwrite that asset of getting, two values and making sure they're within 10% of each other, making sure we're being conservative on that, as well as making sure we underwrite those repair bids appropriately, and we're making sure we're being conservative on those repair bids, then we're really feeling like we're lending on the asset, not the individual, as long as the individual doesn't have bill collectors in the middle of bankruptcy or those types of things. And that's kind of how we weigh our risk out on both of those. The other thing we do to weigh our risk out is we're quick to take a property back. So we'll give people time, but there comes a certain point where we just can't hold on. A traditional bank or something is going to go months and months before they take a property back, or even years. We've got to move a little quicker than that. We're full disclosure and talk with the customer prospect, but we've got to move quickly, because time is typically the enemy to making a deal have returns, either for ourselves if we have to take a property back, unfortunately, or for the borrower that's doing the deal. The longer he takes to do stuff, the interest just does not sleep.
Well, that's right. Time absolutely is the enemy. In fact, yesterday's podcast was all about timing the market cycle. And when I talk about the market cycle, I'm not talking about the macro cycle, from 2007 to 2008 and on down. What I'm talking about is the annual cycle. So for example, we know that in most markets, let's talk about the northern states where it's definitely colder. There's much more activity in April and May than there is in February. And so if you miss that window, let's say you put a property on the market right around Thanksgiving, it's probably going to sit on the market until March. Whereas if you bring a property into the marketplace at the end of February, you've probably timed it perfectly.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's one of two things. You either have to discount to get it sold faster, or you have to, wait it out type of an idea. The only other thing I'd say, Victor, that may have an influence on that is the seller's market right now, in a lot of markets we're in, where there's not enough supply of property. So I think traditionally, there's going to be more homes that are going to sell in the springtime or summertime than there's going to be in the dead of winter. Very few people want to move in the dead of winter. That said, houses sell every month, every day of the year. But the ones that sell are the ones that are priced right, and you get the biggest bang for your buck. So if you're selling in the wintertime, you either need to, unless you're in a seller's market, which there are markets we're in that are in a seller's market where this winter I expect to see decent home sales. There's typically always less home sales in the winter, to your point, than there are in the springtime. The question really becomes is how many homes are on the market versus how many buyers are there? The ratio of buyers to sellers. If there's less buyers and there's less properties, was that ratio worse or better than the number of buyers and properties there are in the summertime? And that's the one thing I'd say in some of these markets we're seeing where it's a seller's market, I think you'll see some interesting things this winter, frankly, because there is such a lack of supply in multiple areas I think you'll see some differences there. That would be the X factor, I would call it.
I think that's right. There's a lot of markets where the demand is certainly there at the price point that you're talking about. It's still the sweet spot. It's really where the majority of Americans are still looking to buy a home. If you go to the top end of the market, if you look at markets, for example, like Seattle, that have become dramatically overbuilt. It's not that the demand isn't there, but the supply-demand imbalance is there, where there's way more supply than demand. That's going to be an issue. And so it's exactly like you said, it's making sure that you've got those fundamentals.
Absolutely agree. And understanding them for your local marketplace.
Well, if folks want to get in touch with you, what's the best way?
Yeah, they can take a look at our website, dohardmoney.com, dohardmoney.com. We've got a link on here, backslash real-estate-expresso. So you can take a look at it. We've got a free book you can download there.
Wonderful. Well, Ryan, great to catch up with you today. And for the listeners at home, if you're looking at doing some short-term projects, if there's a property down the street that looks like the perfect flip, definitely reach out to Ryan at dohardmoney.com. In the meantime, have an awesome rest of your weekend. Go make some great things happen. And we'll talk to you again tomorrow.